This is episode 2 of the Rhode Island Liberty Report. In this episode, Eric and I talk corporate welfare, public school spending, shenanigans in the Rhode Island Sheriff's Division, and business deregulation. So without further ado, on with the show.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report, your source for libertarian commentary on current events in the Ocean State and Southern New England. Coming to you from Rothbard Studios, here are your hosts, Mike and Eric.
All right, welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report from libertyri.com. I'm Mike, and in the studio with me today is my our co-host, ready to tackle the latest issues here in Rhode Island. Eric.
How you doing? I'm here.
Good, good. Something we talked about at the end of the last episode, or the first episode, I should say, was we realized we didn't introduce ourselves and explain the mission of Liberty RI. So I thought we'd take a couple minutes at the beginning of this one to do that, go a little bit of a background on ourselves, spawned Liberty RI, you know, quite a few years back, and give people a little bit of background and some context. So, obviously, I'm Mike. I'm a founder of Liberty RI. I came up with the idea in about, I think it was in September of 2014. I came to libertarianism probably like most people with the Ron Paul movement. And that kind of got me going, although I was headed in that direction for quite some time. I kind of started down the constitutionalist path and then started, you know, what was the point of the Constitution to maximize liberty, and then well what's liberty? So you start going down that rabbit hole and looking into liberty itself and those types of things. So I'm also a veteran, so that had a lot to do with the influence on me becoming a libertarian, not only from a foreign policy perspective, but also from a fraud, waste, and abuse perspective. And most people I talk to that are veterans or have been in the military, or a lot of just government jobs, understand the fraud, waste, and abuse that's inherent in government. So that's kind of where I came from there. And over time, as we go on with the podcast, I'm sure we'll discuss more of our influences, and what brought us to the libertarian movement, and you know, be good discussions moving forward. Just a little background on Liberty RI itself. You know, I discovered back, like I said, in that September 2014, right before the Bob Healey campaign, oddly enough, there was really no outlet for libertarians from a content perspective in Rhode Island. We had the conservative side of things with, at the time, I think it was called Anchors Rising, now the Ocean State Current. I believe they fall under the Center for Freedom and Prosperity now. And then you had Rhode Island Future back then, which was the progressive side of things, and then some other blogs here and there. So that's kind of what spawned the idea for Liberty RI. We started the Facebook page and started going with that. And that led into me getting involved in the Bob Healey campaign, which is where I met Eric. And I'll pass the mic over to Eric and let him explain his transition.
So like Mike, I came to libertarianism through the Ron Paul movement as well. My transition was somewhat slow. I was definitely, back in my college days, I was definitely much more on the left. I was definitely considered myself a socialist. I was a big Obama supporter the first time around when he ran. But I definitely at that time took a particular notice to Dr. Paul, especially in his debates at that time against Rudy Giuliani and Rick Santorum and Fred Thompson and, you know, all the rest. And I was very, very impressed with his foreign policy, especially. But you know, his consistency really stuck with me, and you know, it wasn't long into Obama's first term that I really started sort of shifting my focus. And then, you know, I'd say by 2012, by the time Dr. Paul ran for the second time, I was definitely a full-fledged libertarian. So I met Mike on the Bob Healey campaign. At the time, I was actually still a registered Democrat. Oddly enough, I live in a very Democratic town. I was on the Democratic town committee where I lived. And if you wanted to be involved in local politics in the town, you had to be a Democrat or else you didn't have a voice. So I was a Democrat. And when Healey announced he was running, of course, it was very late in the election season. It was only 2 months to the election. He jumped in very late. And I immediately jumped on and started this Democrats for Healey page. And it just exploded just right from when I first started it. It got a lot of attention, and Bob actually emailed me. He actually reached out to me. And that's how I got involved. He asked me to come on board, and I got involved with the campaign. That's where I met Mike and some other libertarians. It is interesting that, you know, Bob wasn't this overt libertarian, but, you know, his views were extremely libertarian for the most part, which I think we talked a little bit about last episode. He was just such an amazing guy. And I always admired Bob from afar, even as a young guy. I knew all about him. He was sort of a cult figure in Rhode Island for a long time. And actually having the chance to meet him and work with him personally was a real honor. He was just such a smart, super, fiercely intelligent guy with a lot of integrity. And I learned a lot from that campaign. It was very short. It was only a couple of months, but it was a very formative couple of months. And that's where I met Mike, and he had started the Liberty RI page. And, you know, after the Bob Healey thing kind of died down, I kind of backed away from politics a little bit. I am a practicing Quaker, and I've always struggled a lot with politics and how involved I should be and with my faith and everything. And it's definitely been a journey for me, but I've gotten to a place where I feel a really strong sense of morality and a real moral centeredness around my libertarianism. So I got kind of back into the fray, and I met back up with Mike and started writing some articles for the website, some content. There's a lot of stuff on there that I've written. We talked, probably a couple of years ago, we first started talking about doing the podcast, and here we are. We're finally rolling on the podcast. Yeah. So that's kind of where I came from. It's funny. We started this podcast last week. We had our first episode. Of course, we talked about the election. It wasn't one day after, I think it was the day that we actually recorded the first episode where the news about Hasbro broke.
That's right.
And it's like, the hits just keep on coming. And all I could think was, man, we're going to have plenty of content for the show. I don't think we're going to have any trouble coming up with content for this show. It's just, I think there's already been like six or seven things that have come up. We can't even talk about them all in this episode. I don't know, Mike, I, in terms of Hasbro, and this whole thing, just give me your thoughts on it real quick. Just your sort of general impression. Obviously, we don't have a lot of the particulars about the situation yet, but, give me your sense.
So, obviously, Grabian and Pawtucket took a beating on the attempt to, soak the taxpayers for the PawSox, which that was a big win for libertarians and many people across the state and many people involved in that opposition. But, so this is like a preemptive, grease in the skids kind of thing, I think, from Grabian. But it just goes to show the culture here. It's just that this never ending, need to try to, a good point here is a point I often make is when the government, specifically here in Rhode Island, goes after a company and provides them incentives to either one, to get them here, or two, to keep them here, in this case with Hasbro, although we don't know what's going on and what their decisions are, why they're leaving yet. It's all speculation, I think, at this point. But the idea that they have to lower these barriers and create these package deals is the admission that there are barriers there in the first place.
Exactly.
So the government is already admitting there are barriers to business within the state that they've got to lower to get companies here. Why don't they just lower the barriers across the board?
Exactly.
One of my conspiracy hat, you put the tinfoil hat on, is, well, that doesn't get them any favors in the political arena, right? So you lower the barriers for this group, and then they start, giving you, campaign donations, whatever, So
right. It's a means of wielding power.
Quid pro quo, right?
And I actually remember, Governor Raimondo gave a little presentation. It was at Rhode Island College, and it was about a year and a half ago. And I went, and I had the opportunity to ask her a question. And I asked her, and I said, "Look, you're spending all this time flying around the country. You're going to San Francisco. You're going to Chicago. You're going all over the place trying to bring business to the state. Wouldn't it be a lot easier if you just got rid of the corporate tax altogether? And let's say we became one of the one or two states that have zero corporate tax.
Right.
Couldn't you just stay here? You could cut out all the travel, all the effort you're putting in, and it would sort of self-attract businesses to the state. You wouldn't have to sell through the sell job. And she didn't really have a good answer, to be quite honest with you. Her answer was, that's what all states do, and that's what all governors do, and, you know, forward, forward, forward. You know, it's they lose that leverage,
right?
And it's a power game, and it's, you know, they get to pick and choose which businesses they want to save, which ones they don't, which ones they want to come, which ones they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. This is happening on a national level with Amazon. This is right. really blowing up right now. You know, and what really gets me too is, how do we even know that Hasbro is planning on moving in the first place? How do we know that businesses can't just be like, hey, look, we're tired of paying these taxes that we're paying. Let's threaten to leave.
Right.
You know, oh, by the way, Mayor Grebian, we were looking at this great piece of property down in North Carolina, and we're thinking about moving our operation down there. Yeah. It might not even be true.
Right.
But they can use that as leverage, because they know that, you know, these leaders are going to jump to the opportunity to try to throw incentives at them for them to stay. Now, one thing I want to mention, and I think it's important in terms of the terminology, mm-hmm. right? When we talk about corporate welfare, tax breaks are not the same necessarily as corporate welfare.
Correct.
Okay. So in a sense, I mean, allowing a company to keep the money it's already made, which is what a tax break is not in and of itself welfare. Actually, it's sort of like reverse subsidization. You're actually punishing the companies that are paying the tax.
That's right.
More than you're rewarding the company that you're giving the tax break to. Whereas, you know, when you throw big chunks of money at a company and you give them subsidies, that's more like sort of traditional corporate welfare. Like when Citizens Bank decided to build a huge campus in Johnston, the state threw tons of money at them for some infrastructure costs, building it. They built an extra on-ramp on the highway, things like that. That's corporate welfare. So I just wanted to get that out there, because obviously we'd like to see all the taxes go away.
Right. No, and that's a great distinction, or defining those parameters to that, you know, and a lot of, you know, and you'll hear libertarians will argue against even the tax breaks. And, you know, I don't necessarily always agree with that. It's, you know, the argument there is they're picking winners and losers, you know, and there's something to be said for that. Right. So, there is an argument there. I can't argue with a business doing what they feel is in the best interest of the business. Right. When I do my taxes, my personal taxes at the end of the year, I claim all the deductions I possibly can. Right. Because I want to pay as little tax as possible.
Right.
So if there's an opportunity for me to, as an individual, to limit my tax burden, I'm going to do that same thing. A business is going to do the same. Their responsibility is to either the owner or the shareholders if they're a publicly traded company. So you can't really fault them for doing that. The problem is the government is willing to play that game, right? And they're willing to negotiate with that, and they should just be, you know, fair across the board, which I think is a point that you have. Is it's
right,
you know.
Well, there's secondary consequences, you know, to the tax break thing compared to the, you know, whereas with the subsidies is much more of a direct consequence. With the tax breaks, it's you've got politicians who are making this political decisions, right? This is what they are. They can say they're economic decisions. Oh, this will be good for the economy, but really it's political. Mm-hmm. Okay, and instead of the market deciding whether or not a company should stay or leave, you've got these politicians making that decision for us. If the taxes themselves get in the way as well of the market doing its thing.
Right.
And that's an intervention that screws things up. But I think, you know, you bring up a good point in terms of, you know, and I think actually we'll bring this up a little bit later in the podcast is, you know, when is it okay to, you know, try to get back the money that's been taken from you in the first place, right? Like when, you know, how much is acceptable? When does it become a moral hazard to do that, to get money from the government? Because, you know, you could say, okay, well, you're getting money from the government. That's, you know, that's stolen money. Well, it was stolen from you in the first place.
Right.
Right. So that's an interesting question. I definitely want to bring it up a little later in the podcast when we get to a different issue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, I kind of agree with you. I mean, these taxes in and of themselves create these sorts of situations where companies are in the position of having to try to, make these plays.
Right.
And it puts everybody in a very compromised position, which they shouldn't be in the first place.
Right. And also, I think we should mention that we don't know what Hasbro's motives are here. They very well could be just doing internal, you know, audits and discussions on, you know, is Rhode Island best for us as a business, right? They might they might see better opportunity from either a logistical standpoint or who knows what the many reasons a company may move or relocate.
Right.
So it could be perfectly innocent on the part of Hasbro.
Totally.
And they just it's the best decision for them, and again for them and their shareholders. And
right. And I think it is worth mentioning that, you know, I think a lot of times people look at us like as libertarians, like we're always beating up on somebody, right?
Right.
I mean, Hasbro over the course of time has, you know, for all intents and purposes, been very good to the state in the sense that they've stayed here. You know, they've done a lot of charitable work, tons of charitable work, between the hospital. They're all different sorts of things. So, you know, yeah, like, you know, I don't think we're trying to say that they're bad, you know, or that they have malintent. They very well may not, and it's probably likely that they don't.
Right. Now, another point I'd like to hit on too is, you know, the fact is if they do leave, what they leave behind, right? So the idea that they leave and we lose 1,000 jobs, I think is the number that's been thrown out there. The reality is, well, we gain 1,000 people in the labor force, that 1,000 people within the labor force that have skills now within, you know, office management, project management, administrative staff, all this, what they mainly do here at their headquarters building. But that's an opportunity for a sell as well. Again, lower the barriers across the board so other companies will come in. There's already a quote unquote trained workforce that they can capitalize on.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that, you know, look, this is where, you know, the way the progressives deal with this sort of situation is so fascinating, because they're really stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? Because they're so anti-corporate welfare. But the fact that they're such economic interventionists puts them in a compromised position, because now it's like, okay, well, do we stick to our guns with, you know, the lack of corporate welfare? Do we let Hasbro leave, or do we save the jobs?
Right.
Do we give them what they want and fight for the working man and save the jobs? What do you do?
Right.
Yeah. We don't have that problem.
No. We're consistent across
the board that there should be no market interventions. They're not. And the other thing with the progressives too is they really do seem to pick and choose which corporations that they like and which ones they don't like. They're not anti-corporate welfare. Let me repeat that. Progressives are not against corporate welfare. They're against corporate welfare for corporations that they don't like.
Yeah.
That is the truth. If it's a renewable energy company like Deepwater Wind, people like Aaron Regenberg are going to line up to write legislation and throw millions and millions and millions of dollars their way.
Right.
So don't believe for a second that progressives are against corporate welfare. They are not. Libertarians are against corporate welfare in every instance, all the time.
All the time. Exactly. We'll be covering this quite often. It seems to be this perpetual theme within Rhode Island. They just continually do it over and over and over again. And I think as we talk later on in the podcast, we're going to come back, circle back around to this on a positive note, and talk about something
right.
that can help in the other direction.
Because believe it or not, the news isn't all bad
right.
all the time.
Right.
Sometimes there is good news. The next topic that I really wanted to talk about, and I brought this up mainly because of what we talked about last episode in terms of the bond referendums, okay?
Yeah.
So the first bond referendum was a $250 million bond for school renovations, right, throughout the state. And of course, that's the principal, right? So if you add in the interest, it's actually going to cost somewhere around $400 million by the time we're all done to repair the schools, because the schools are falling apart. The towns and the cities have done a crappy job of keeping up these schools. And the main question that has come up in this discussion is why? Why are the schools falling apart? What is the reasoning? You know, what's the rationale for that? I did a little bit of digging here. News came out recently that the Providence Teachers Union had reached a tentative agreement with the city for a new contract. They've been working without a contract for about a year. Their last contract ended in 2017, which basically just means that they're continuing to work under that contract, under the last year of that contract. So I thought it would be worthwhile to go through the contract that they're currently working on just a little bit, give some of the basics about what's in that contract. And then I wanted to talk about the school budget a little bit and maybe shed some light on why these schools are falling apart. Mm. Okay. There is, to me, there's a very clear reason. So first, I just want to go through the contracts a little bit. So first, the salaries for the teachers. Currently, under the last year of the contract, a first step teacher, and I will explain what that means in a second, a first step teacher makes $40,547 a year. And that's based on 181 workdays. Okay. A 12th step teacher makes $76,427 a year. Now, what are these steps? It is statutorily written, and it is the law that teachers must get automatic raises from their first year until their 12th year. And those raises are written into law. Now, the amount of the raise can be different depending on the town. That stuff is negotiated, but it's set in stone,
right,
in each contract, what those steps are going to be. Now, when you hear about, you know, let's say a freeze on raises, let's say that a town agrees to a contract with the teachers union and there's no raises. Let's say this 0-0-0, those 3 years of that contract. That does not include the steps. Mm-hmm. They're still getting their step raises. Those are mandated by law. So any raise that they get is in addition to that raise that they're getting statutorily mandated. Okay. So just to give you a sense of what's in the contract, there's a lot of perks, a lot of benefits, right? So the teachers get about 60% of their health coverage is paid for under the contract, and they get full dental. They get 15 paid sick days.
Yeah.
So just to give you a, now it doesn't sound like a lot when you say like 15 days, it doesn't sound like a lot, but think about it this way. If you work 5 days a week and you took one day off a week, okay, for 4 months straight.
Yeah.
That's 15 sick days.
Right.
Okay. So that gives you a sense. Okay. And these are all paid. You get full pay. And you can accumulate up to 150 sick days. So if you don't use them, they roll over to the next year. So you can accumulate up to 150 days. That's almost an entire full school year,
right,
worth of paid sick time. Okay. You get 2 days if you get married. You get 3 days for religious observances that you don't already get off, like Christmas and things like that. If you're a union delegate, you get 5 days paid. You get 2 to 5 personal days. And some of that is at the discretion of the superintendent. You get 5 days off at half pay. And you get 1 to 5 days for bereavement, depending on who dies. If it's an immediate family member, 5 days. If it's a cousin, you get 1 day.
Gotcha.
Okay. So look, I'm not bringing this stuff up to ridicule teachers. They have a very hard job to do, especially in some of these, some of these schools they're downright dangerous environments. Okay. It's a very hard job. But you know, the fact of the matter is, and there's really no way of getting around this, is that the teachers, you know, when you say a teacher makes, you know, a first year teacher makes $40,000 a year, you can't ignore the fact that they're working 180 days a year. You just can't. The average number of work days per year is 260. Mm-hmm. That's if you work 5 days a week for a full year. Okay. That's around the average, around 40 hours a week, 5 days, 8 hours a day. That's the average. Okay. So when you break it down, a first step teacher is making about $1,200 a week. That's what they're making. Okay. Right. And this is just, I'm just putting the facts out there so everyone has an idea of what they're making. Okay. And the reason I'm putting all this out there is because I'm going to talk about the budget. The Providence School District budget. Okay. Their total expenses for the last year was $378 million for the entire district. Okay. $291 million of that was in employee salaries and benefits. That's 76% of the entire budget. Is salaries and benefits. 76%.
Yeah.
Okay. How much, Mike, do you think of the budget goes towards maintenance? It's non-custodial maintenance. So I'm not talking about cleaning the floors and, you know, cleaning the toilets. I'm talking about if a window breaks, if a ceiling tile falls, if there's mold growing on the carpets. How much of that budget do you think goes towards non-custodial maintenance and repairs on the buildings? If you had to guess. They a reasonable guess.
I'd like to, 5%.
5%?
Yeah.
It's one half of 1%, 0.006%. These are the numbers right in the budget. You can get it online. I'm not making this up. $2.4 million is what's budgeted for non-custodial maintenance and repairs in the schools,
right?
Compared to $291 million that the teachers make. The rest of the budget is made up of transportation costs, busing, you know, in special education costs, you know, lots of other things. But just think about those numbers for a second. And to me, this is why the schools are falling apart.
Right. Now, just quick question. Did you mention administrative costs? Is that lumped into the teacher, the personnel, or is administration?
No, this was just salaries and benefits. So that includes administrator salaries as well.
Okay.
So the principals, the superintendent,
vice principal, dean of students.
Right. The secretaries. Yeah. Anyone who collects a salary.
Right.
And anyone, you know, in the school department.
Yeah.
Not just teachers. So I shouldn't just single them out. It's not just the teachers. It's everybody who makes a salary who works in the school department.
I'd actually be interested to break out the administration versus teachers as well.
That would be very interesting.
I mean, once you start getting into administration in education, my wife's a teacher, so she had a charter school teacher. But once you start getting into administration, you know, you're looking, I mean, that's a significant bump, right?
Right.
So, but not to say, you know, still the discrepancy between, and it goes back to what we were talking about in the referendums last podcast, which was the fact that they don't plan for maintaining these buildings and they fall into disrepair.
And then
all of a sudden, we need $250 million to fix our crumbling school system.
Right. So what happens is, you know, and look, that's because these decisions are not economic decisions, they're political decisions.
Right.
When you have, you know, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, as libertarians, we believe in a free market, and that applies to anything. It applies to education as well. And the fact is that you have the teachers' union, which, look, they're doing their job. They're fighting for the best possible contract they can. They're doing their job. But the problem is that they have a monopoly on that labor.
Right.
The school department can't go and hire someone non-union. It's against the law. Right. So what happens is that, you know, the costs of things get out of whack. There is no business in the world that spends 76% of its money on its employees. It would be out of business. It wouldn't survive. Things would fall apart. The buildings would collapse and they'd be out of business. That's just how it would work. Now, just to give you just one last comparison here, which I think is also telling, the per pupil cost in the Providence School District. Okay. So that's it. You take the entire budget divided by the number of students.
Right.
It's $17,260 per student. Okay. Let's compare that to LaSalle Academy, which is, you know, a very well-respected school in Providence, private school, parochial school, known for its really good academics, its great athletics, its great facilities, everything. The per pupil cost at LaSalle, in terms of tuition, is on average for a high school student, $15,500. So it's actually
cheaper,
about close to $2,000 cheaper per student. They're doing it cheaper.
Right.
Yeah. And getting better results. And so, look, the model is wrong. And I want to hear you talk a little bit, Mike, about the model. If we, you know, if we get some time on this subject in terms of, you know, and I know you were talking a little bit about to me pre-show about the technology.
Right.
And how, you know, the whole model of this brick and mortar education system is completely antiquated.
Right. The whole Prussian model, I believe, is what it dates back to. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. It's,
right.
It's crazy. You know, and now as technology advances, you're starting to cut out, you know, they have the ability to cut out, you know, traditional type education. So, you know, I'm convinced going forward, you know, in the next 10, 15, 20 years, it's going to be interesting to see the struggle to maintain control of the education, public education system from government and how alternative means of education are going to be, you know, they're going to be competing against.
Right.
And I'll use myself as an example, although I'm not in public education, you know, I'm well out of high school, many years. I'm wanting to learn some programming skills, right? So Python, I'm looking to learn how to program in Python, right? So I get online and what do I find? There's dozens of online resources to learn for free. And, you know, one of them is edX.org, edX.org. And they've partnered with a bunch of universities across the country, and I'm talking like MIT, Berkeley, Harvard, you know, and other just your normal school, regular, you know, those are obviously elite schools, but you know, so You can go on there and take a computer science class, learning basic programming skills from MIT using their curriculum, their teachers, for free, absolutely free. If you want a certificate at the end to you know, prove that you've got this knowledge, you can pay $75 for the certificate.
Right.
But if you just want the knowledge, it's free.
Totally free. And that's the thing that these schools really bank on is the certificate. It's the diploma. And that's really what you're paying for. And it's supposed to give you a leg up in the job world. Right. But I think what we're finding is it's really not anymore.
No.
It's really not. And look, can you imagine that the teachers' unions are not going to sit or stand by, idly by, when, you know, you could have one teacher teaching, you know, from California.
Yeah.
Some brilliant person do a curriculum on history, let's say European history.
Right.
And you could use that same curriculum, those same video lectures or whatever, in every single classroom. You pay a teacher's aide to be in the room to make sure the kids are paying attention, doing their work. They can answer any questions or whatever, and they've got source materials. And you've just eliminated this entire, you've eliminated a huge cost to the system.
For sure.
And it's not, the government getting in the way is stopping that progress from happening. And it is progress. That is progress.
Absolutely. And the other aspect of this is the ability to customize your education to the type of learner you are.
Absolutely.
Whereas in a typical public school classroom, it's the lowest common or the average student, right? So
it's a one size fits all model.
Exactly. Where now you can go out and seek the type of education. You know, I was a hands-on learner, right? So if I was to sit and say physics class, the drawing on the board, no idea. I had the opportunity when I was not, they had an applied physics class, right? So it was through experimentation you learn physics and you're building things and figuring out fulcrums and you know, all this other stuff. That's the way I learned, right?
Right.
So, you know, same thing with math class, right? Sit in algebra 2, no idea. No, you know, right. I was lost. I went into my electronics class when there was, you know, page long algebra formulas that you had to do to figure out circuitry. And I could fill in those blanks because I'm looking at I'm physically figuring this out.
And instead of you spending the vast majority of your time in those environments, you're wasting your time.
But those are exceptions. Right. Yeah. And then those opportunities are exceptions in today's education. And then there's the other side of this too, which is the pushback on this, right? Well, without public education, how will we educate the children, right?
Right.
How will they learn? Not everybody can afford tuition. You know, it's too expensive. But the reality is there's opportunities out there to have still free private public education.
Right.
Either through philanthropy or, you know, partnerships with, you know, companies or, you know, that type of stuff. So, again, if people want to fund education, they will fund education.
Right. Well, it's sort of like our argument with healthcare. The same thing. I mean, what you would do is if you got rid of the public monopoly, and obviously it's not a total monopoly because there are private schools and it's not like private schools are illegal or anything, but they can outcompete very easily and they dominate the landscape. The truth is if all of a sudden all the people who send their private schools tomorrow decided to send their kids to public school, the public schools would be dead.
Right.
They would not be able to handle it. So, but the thing is, if you got rid of that, the socialized education, the costs of education in all the private schools would come way down. You'd have a million different types of schools.
Competition.
You know, there might be a school that costs $3,000 a year.
Yep.
Now look, you might have to pay that $3,000 a year, but that's pretty cheap
right.
for an education. And for people who fall through the cracks, there would undoubtedly be charities and nonprofits that could help them.
So here's an interesting thing. And I found out about this last year, maybe 6 months ago. Rhode Island allows companies to donate to needs-based scholarships for private schools, but they've capped it. They've capped it at $1.5 million.
Wow, really?
So they actually get more companies willing to donate to private schools than they allow.
Huh.
And one of the benefits to donating to these scholarship funds is a tax break, right?
Right.
So there was, a push, I believe it was Lancia who tried to push a bill, who's now no longer in the assembly, to raise the cap to $5 million. And it never went anywhere, of course, right? So this isn't just, it's for needs-based. So this money goes to kids who couldn't afford private school,
but they want to go. Right.
But they want to go and they're get smart. A scholarship. Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's why is there any cap at all? Not even the $5 million that they wanted to raise it to. Why not let businesses donate as much money as they want to allow kids to go to private school?
There's got to be a good reason.
Yeah. Oh, no.
And in this moment, I can't think of a good reason, but I guarantee you they've thought of a good reason and they're running to the end zone with it. So
they don't want opportunity for kids to go to private school. Yeah. Now, full disclosure, my daughter goes to a private high school and she's a senior getting ready to go to college. And I tell you, we had her. So she went to charter school for the first up till fifth grade. She went to the regular public school from sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, middle school, and high school, private school. I can't even tell you the difference in the quality of education at a private school.
Oh, it's night and day.
It's not even comparable.
And there are a lot of reasons for that. And I think one of them, honestly, is in a lot of ways is educator freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, most teachers get into teaching because they want to teach and they love to teach. And there's a huge burnout rate in public schools because they're teaching to a test. They don't have a lot of freedom to do the things they want to do. In a private school, there's all kinds of freedom and creative things that teachers can do in the classroom. I went to a private school my whole life.
Yep.
And it was always interesting and there were always new things happening in the classroom. It's not like that in public school. It's very rudimentary. It's very uninspired, you know, and it's not the teacher's fault most of the time. It's the way the system is set up and it's the way the rules are dictated to them.
Right.
So, and there's a lot of other reasons, obviously, too.
Yeah.
My daughter's not school age yet. She still goes to Little Gym. So
there you go.
But eventually we're going to have to look at that, make that decision.
Yeah. Now, we've been talking about this for a little bit, so I won't get into it. But there's also the idea of vouchers. And I think there's a libertarian argument against vouchers.
Yeah, it's not.
I don't know if we could cover that today. Maybe it's
it might be a topic for another time.
Because we're going to talk about education again.
education is one of those things, I think, that is just, it's... Most school departments make up about 50% of every town budget. It's a major issue, and it will always be a major issue. And not just because it costs so much, but also because we're talking about the education of our children.
Yeah.
And I think another thing that's interesting to be good to talk about would be the history of public education in the country and why it started. And as a Quaker, I can tell you there's some roots there that go way back to there being lots of religious reasons why public education began to be mandated and things like that. So
I'd also like to visit the idea of the impact public education has on indoctrination and that whole aspect of it as well. It's right. It's important for government to keep the masses in their system. Right?
What kind of history are they learning?
Yeah.
Exactly. Kind of thing. That would be fascinating.
So, we'll certainly hit that up. But
moving on to
corruption.
Oh man, this story, man. So, the story broke this week about the Rhode Island sheriffs. And if you haven't heard about it, let me just give you the quick rundown of basically what happened. Basically, WPRI did a story, came out this week about the Rhode Island sheriffs. Now, the sheriffs, there's three state law enforcement agencies, right? There's the state police, there's the Capitol Police, and then there's the sheriffs.
Okay.
That's basically, then you have the correctional officers as well.
Yep.
So there's, I guess, four. And what happened was basically is that there's this thing called injured on duty when you're a law enforcement officer. I don't know if it's the same for firefighters or not. But basically what it means is if you're injured, if you get injured on the job or you get injured in whatever situation you get injured and you're still considered on duty, you're paid your full salary while you're out. Not only your full salary. Let me go step back for a second. You're paid your full salary, and that's the way it is for every law enforcement agency. What's interesting about the sheriffs is that salary is tax-free. So if you're injured on duty, you're actually making more money than you would if you were working. Now, the other law enforcement agencies, with the exception of the sheriffs, have an 18-month cap on how long you can be injured on duty on that designation, which actually sounds like kind of a long time to be injured on duty to me. But for the sheriffs, up until a few years ago, there was no time limit whatsoever. So there are actually a handful of sheriffs who are currently injured on duty and have been for about 10 years. And they've been collecting their full salary tax-free for the past 10 years and have not worked one single day. OK, Okay. Now, it was a few years ago, they put a cap on it. The cap is 5 years. Right. That's the cap that they put on is 5 years. So now there's a whole bunch of other sheriffs who basically they will collect or have been collecting their full salary tax-free. And then once the 5 years is up, then they collect 70% of their salary also tax-free, which basically amounts to what their original salary was in the first place when they were paying taxes. Okay. So, you know, this is a big scandal because there's about 23, I believe the news story said 23 sheriffs
yeah.
currently out of, I think 160 or 170 sheriffs or something like that. Did it say there?
Yeah, 179.
179. There's yeah. 23 currently renowned sheriffs who were injured on duty. And just by comparison, I think the state police, there's three out of 256 troopers. There's three. So look, again, you don't know the individual cases here. There's a lot of privacy implications, especially sure. when you're talking with medical conditions and injuries and things like that. You know, and I think that that's worthy of discussion as well, is when does the public have a right to know these sorts of things? I personally think if there's a medical procedure and we're paying for it, we should know what that procedure was. We don't need to know what your medical condition is necessarily. We don't need to get into the private nature of whatever your ailment is. But if you had back surgery and we're paying for it, I think we should know you had back surgery,
right?
Or you didn't, or whatever. And you know, so you don't know if all these injuries are legitimate.
Well, that brings up a good point. If you don't want us to know, then don't charge us for it, right? So that's the simple solution to that
right.
problem. If you want the privacy, then stop stealing the money out of our pockets. You know,
I get the medical privacy thing. I really do. But doesn't the person who's paying for it have a right to know? At the same time, I mean, I think that, you know, I think there are privacy implications, and as libertarians, we care very much about privacy. But you know, we also care about non-aggression,
right? Well, here's an example of a service that we're paying for that we're not getting anything. We're not getting anything for it. You know, we're paying for a service that we're not getting any return
right.
on, and that's always the argument that we hear, right? Well, you know, the first thing when we say taxation is theft. Well, who's going to pay for the roads and the police and the fire department and all this other stuff? Well, here we are paying for sheriff services that we're not getting, you know, our
right.
quote unquote money's worth. So how do I get yep. my refund?
Like, right.
you know,
where's my refund?
Where's my refund?
Where's my Valpak coupon in the mail?
if I go to, I pay for a service or I, you know, in the private sector, in the marketplace, if I pay for something or I'm not happy with a product, I return it, I get a refund.
Like, right.
You know, I get some kind of compensation or I'm made whole for the money that I invested into that and I didn't get my money's worth.
You know? Can you imagine you pay for a boiler guy to come over and fix your boiler?
Right.
And you pay up front and the guy doesn't show?
Yeah.
And that's it? You don't? No, you're getting your money back. Am I right?
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
The funny thing too about this particular situation is that the sheriffs who are not out on duty are kind of pissed off because they have to hold the spot open. They can't hire somebody else.
So they're doing more work.
So they're doing more work. And you know, part of this news story was
for less pay than the guy that decided to go.
They're doing more work for less pay than the person who's not working.
Sitting on his couch.
And you know, and
or her.
Yeah. And you know, I think they're kind of pissed off because now they're shorthanded. And look, these sheriffs, they transfer prisoners between cells and the courthouses. They protect the judges. They do all sorts of things. And they're put in a compromised position. And I think part of the story was that they're actually closing down some courthouses and some courtrooms because they don't have the adequate protection for the judges and et cetera, et cetera. Whereas with a teacher, when a teacher's out, you know, you're hiring a sub to fill them.
Right.
And it's actually an extra cost in that sense, But in this sense, it's actually, there's an extra cost because it's tax-free. The salary is tax-free, but at the same time, you're not even getting an adequate service.
No.
For what you're paying for. So it's
well, that's to the point, right? So you're now paying for a service that's decreasing and you're paying more.
It's asinine. Yeah, it really is. It's totally asinine. I mean, and look, this news story broke and it's shocking. I wouldn't be surprised if the story totally disappeared.
Right.
Within a week.
Just goes away.
You know, and I think it is worth noting that the Raimondo administration did try to put a stop to this.
Okay.
I think this was in the news story as well. Last year in the budget, they tried to reduce this time limit to 18 months and keep it in line with the other law enforcement agencies. Ooh, slipped into my Rhode Island accent there for a second. It does happen sometimes when I get uppity. Of course, the union showed up at the state house and they lobbied the lawmakers and they took out that provision. Wow. Look, again, political decisions. It's all political.
Right.
Political decisions should be kept in the political realm. They should not get into anything that has to do with the marketplace. And look, we're used to the police and the sheriffs and the fire departments and the schools all being government run and government services, but they do not have to be. There's no reason they have to be. It's a fallacy. It's a myth. And I think that's one thing we'll probably get into in further episodes is the libertarian solutions to these sorts of things and the free market solutions to these things, which are way, way better.
Way better.
Way better.
And a little, this kind of goes, again, another example of the abuse that's inherent in the Rhode Island culture, right? And what is it? Matt Allen, tip of the hat to Matt Allen about the putrid Rhode Island gene.
The putrid Rhode Island gene, that's right.
How many times have you run into, say, an old high school friend or someone you knew back in the day who got a state job and now is on disability and like talking about living the dream and bragging to you about it drives me.
And this brings me back to the point I brought up originally when we were talking about the corporate welfare, which is, obviously if you're working a state job, then your entire salary is based off of tax dollars to begin with. But let's say you're not, right? Let's say you're not working a state job and, you get hurt or whatever, and you want to go on disability. Or let's say you want to get some sort of tax credit for this or tax credit for that. My main question is it moral to take from the government is it immoral to take from the government in any situation, or is it reasonable? Is it actually reasonable and actually makes sense to take from the government as long as what you're taking doesn't exceed what they've taken from you?
Right.
Well, and I think that's a valid question.
No, that's a good point. And we talked about Ron Paul earlier in our introduction there. And he used to get criticized quite often about earmarking pet projects for his district.
Right.
And he has a perfectly legitimate explanation for that. He's like, I'm trying to get the money back to my district that the federal government stole from them in the first place.
Right. And obviously, if he could, he would give that money back in the form of a tax credit, but he can't.
Right.
So he does it in whichever way, the next best thing.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with that. And that's why I don't think that earmarks are necessarily a bad thing. I think that the way that they're used and the way that they're implemented.
Well, that's different.
Is totally messed up. If there was some sort of an equal, if there was some sort of formula where every district got back the amount of money that district put in.
Right.
Or a portion of it, obviously.
For example, say, he's getting money back for road and, infrastructure improvement.
Right.
Everybody benefits from that. Like as you said, you can't give it to the individual, but you try to give it to, you're not necessarily giving it to a person
right.
or a contract,
right.
within that and within your district, but you're giving it, right. Again, there's still abuse in that,
you know,
because we know the contracts get bit, the
bridge,
go out.
Bridge to nowhere.
Exactly.
Right.
So that does happen. But you can sympathize, right?
Right.
There's something to be further discussed and looked into there. It's not just nefarious.
But I think that the fundamental point here too is that, look, if you didn't have these taxes in the first place, if you didn't have the income tax, then you wouldn't have to worry about any of this stuff. And it really does create a moral hazard for everybody involved. It does. It puts everyone in a weird position where they're like, okay, well, look, they're taking my money. I want to get some of that money back. Yep. And it creates all this, it creates this huge mess. And in terms of, the progressives love to talk about the corporate influence in politics and the campaign donations. Look, you want to get rid of corporate involvement in politics and you want to get rid of all the campaign money that they give, then shrink government.
Right.
If government wasn't so important and government didn't do so much and didn't have the power to help out these companies, they wouldn't waste their money on the politicians.
I've often said that in response to people complaining about the money in politics. And my response is, you take away the power to the politicians, that money, you can give them all the money in the world. It doesn't matter. They don't have any power to do anything. So
right.
If the government's small, there's
right.
it doesn't matter.
And if you look, actually, you can look and you can map a correlation. between the increase in the amount of money that government spends every year and the amount of money that is spent on lobbying and political campaigns.
Right.
They are in sync. As the government spends more and more money, so do the lobbyists and so do the campaign donors.
Yep. So you take away their power to do anything with their position, and they're not going to get the money because there's no reason to give them any
money. Right. And actually, I mean, and honestly, that money could be so much better used in so many more productive areas.
Creating jobs, expanding business.
Look how much money Gina spent on the election. I mean, Gina, was it $5 million?
Yeah,
$6 million on the election? I mean, that money could have been spent in so many other better ways.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, because the people who give this money have an interest, and there's a necessity there to have the government on their side, right? Because the government is so pervasive.
Well, Bastiat, right? Broken window fallacy.
Exactly. And that's, you know, maybe that's a, you know, that
that's
might,
the episode.
That might work well as a libertarian 101 short video, that broken window fallacy. We're not going to get into that right now, but you know, I'll tell you what, go.
There's an article on libertyri.com about the Bostocks and the broken window fallacy.
There absolutely is.
Yeah.
The wonders of technology.
There you go.
So,
We're getting close to the end here. We'll, go with our last,
wrap up some good news.
Yeah. Some good, ended on a good note, on a positive note here, and, talking about deregulation and how that actually works.
It's amazing how it works.
So if you want to,
you know, what's funny about this particular story, and this just came out today, actually, I just saw this come out today on, and I get credit at WPRO.com for this story. And it's about the brewing industry in Rhode Island. Now, what's funny is that before I even laid eyes on the story, I kind of had this innate sense. Like, you kind of, and you see, and I've seen it in the newspaper, this brewery's opening here, this brewery's opening in this town, new brewery comes to Pawtucket, new brewery comes to Tiverton or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's definitely been on my mind. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of breweries opening.
Right.
This is crazy, right? Like why all of a sudden, right? Well, turns out there's a very, very good reason for that. So it turns out that up until a couple of years ago, there was heavy, heavy regulation of the brewing industry in Rhode Island. And basically the regulations that we're talking about here were that breweries were not allowed to sell their product on the premises. Mm-hmm. Okay. So think about how crazy that is.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if a restaurant couldn't sell their product on the premises. If they made them make their pasta fazools and their, you know, their chicken Florentine, whatever, and then they had to ship it off to some third party distributor,
right,
or you know, some dinner store,
right?
And then you had to go to the dinner store and pick up your chicken Florentine, and you weren't actually able to go sit down at the restaurant where the food was prepared and cooked for you fresh and buy it there. It's insane. But this was a law. This was a law, and the brewing companies were not allowed to do this. So on top of that, the licensing for opening a brewery in Rhode Island, it would cost $3,000 yearly for a license to operate a brewery. And that was reduced by our Rhode Island government to $500. That's a huge difference.
Big time.
Big difference.
Especially for starting a young, small startup business.
And obviously, we'd like to see it be zero.
For sure.
But
there shouldn't
be
a license.
That's a huge improvement. I mean, that's an amazing improvement. And what was the result of this? In a mere 2 years, the number of breweries in the state has tripled, according to this report. Tripled.
It's amazing.
Tripled. Amazing.
Yeah.
What you do when you tear down the barriers. And, the meme that I love is, and I use this in my talk at the Liberty Forum, is there's the meme of the three people at the baseball field, right? And there's a fence, and they're trying to see over the fence. And there's the tall guy, there's the medium-sized guy, and then there's the little child there. And they're all standing on the ground and they're trying to look over the fence, and only the tall guy can see over the fence, right? So the progressives would say, well, look, the shorter people need a boost to be able to see over the fence, because look, they're not equal. Libertarians want to get rid of the fence.
Right.
Get rid of the fence. Everyone can see.
Yeah.
Get a chain link fence.
That's right.
So you can see through it.
See through it.
Okay. And it just goes to show you that. And this goes back to the corporate welfare thing again. Look, it obviously works when you tell people they're not going to have to pay any taxes. When if you get rid of the tax burden, the cost of business, they come.
Right.
They want to build. And the best thing you can do is get rid of these things permanently. Because what happens is when you throw sort of specialized tax breaks at companies, the second those tax breaks go away, they want to pack up and move to the next state where they can get the tax break. So this is a great thing that the state has done. You know, and the governor. For all her faults, and she has many of them, believe me, she has done some good things in regards to business. It's undeniable. I think one other thing she did was she got rid of the small business tax, which I think was $500 a year.
Right.
She got rid of that. So now small businesses don't have to pay that $500 yearly tax. And she deserves credit for that. And I think it's important that for you know all the griping that we do, which is totally legitimate, mm-hmm. About the government and how intrusive it is, sometimes they do things that are objectifiably good.
Right.
And this is not some, you know, and again, this is not some special favor that's being done to the brewing industry. This is putting them in line with every other industry. Like I mentioned, the restaurants, okay? You know, the butchers, right? Right. Any other business, you can go in into wherever that product is made and buy it there. So this is a fantastic thing. It's leveling the playing field, and we are seeing the results. Right. We are seeing the results. We have one of the hottest, fastest growing brewing industries in the country right now here in Rhode Island, and it is all due to this.
Yep. And it, just to nail home the point is, you know, just a slight amount of deregulation, like we said, they dropped the licensing fee from 3,000 to 500. You know, just these small incremental, that just, and you have an explosion. Imagine if you just got rid of the barrier altogether, like how much of a
wow.
It boggles the mind, and it proves the point that regulation stifles.
It stifles it. It's not doing anyone any good. No. And I think when someone wants to open a brewery and they're looking around, okay, where am I going to open a brewery? And they say, oh, look at this. Oh, Rhode Island has no licensing fee.
Yeah.
And every other state in the area has a licensing fee. Well, that's a no brainer. I'm going to go open it up in Rhode Island.
Right.
And we get the jobs, we get the economic activity. You know, it's just good to see that, you know, the news isn't all bad. Okay. It's really not. And it is important to highlight, these sorts of things.
And especially when it's an example of what we continuously preach. It's almost a I told you so kind of,
right.
You know,
right. And, you know, I mean, obviously the sad part about it is that this is a very small example. And in the grand scheme of things, another article that came out today, Rhode Island's economy, according to U.S. Commerce, this is the United States Commerce Department of Commerce. Yeah. Which, you know, shouldn't even exist, but it exists. And they do these kinds of reports. And we are tied for the third worst in growth of all the states. Whereas when it comes to the brewing industry on its own, we're one of the best
right. In
growth.
Yeah.
Let's apply the principles that have been applied to the brewing industry to everything else. And guess what? We will have the best growth in the country if we get rid of the corporate tax. You know, and that's an issue I think we can talk about next time, is the corporate tax, because that's something that we could very easily get rid of. And it would be an instant attraction, mm-hmm. a magnet to mm-hmm. business coming to the state.
Yeah. Now, and this article that you're referencing, I just posted it up to libertyri.com Facebook page, I'm sorry, before we started this. You've got to read this, because it's actually quite interesting how they're, you know, using Rhode Island as a predictor for an upcoming potential recession. So,
right.
You know, Rhode Island first in, last out is something they use in the article.
Man, I hope, and I really hope history is not going to repeat itself. No. And sadly, it always seems to. But yeah, it's a fascinating article. Get yourself to libertyri.com and click the link to the article. It's really good stuff. It's got some really great information in there, and it really sheds light on, you know, the overall business climate in the state. But, you know, again, it's important to look at successes. It's important to look at things that work, so and to shine light on them so that we can apply that same logic to everything else.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll post a link. Actually, I want to post a link, something I didn't do on the last podcast, all the links to the articles that we're referencing in our show notes.
That's a great idea.
So it'll be on the website, and then Eric will mention all the other avenues you can access.
Right. So if you want to find us, you can go to libertyri.com. That's our sort of our home base. Hold on one second. Right. So you can go to libertyri.com. You can find us on Facebook, LibertyRI, Twitter, LibertyRI. You can also find the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify, and you know, many other major podcast platforms. Please subscribe if you like the show. Leave us a review. Make sure you give us a good rating. It really helps with the search results and stuff like that. You can also email each of us individually. I'm Eric at libertyri.com, mike@libertyri.com. Feel free to send us ideas, things you want us to talk about. We really want there to be a lot of an audience engagement with the show. And we've already really enjoyed engaging with people on Facebook in the comment section. We'd love to engage with you via email as well. Yeah. So please join us. We'll look forward to getting back into this next week. And we hope to see you then.
Yeah, for sure. Till then, take care.
You've been listening to the Rhode Island Liberty Report. Be sure to check us out at libertyri.com.